All right, we're here with Benko, one of our favorites on Channel 9. So
hi, Larry.
I want to talk a little bit about like your background and how you came to Microsoft Research. We've often heard about some of the projects that you've worked on, but let's hear a little bit about you.
Sure. Well, I come from a pretty academic background. Like a lot of researchers at MSR, prior to MSR, I was actually a PhD student. I went to Columbia and I did a lot of augmented reality work there. I worked in a lab where pretty much my whole existence was spent with having to wear head-worn displays or head-mounted displays. We did augmentations and different projects, really interesting projects, but visualizing archaeological dig sites, visualizing a lot of repair and maintenance scenarios for kind of airplane engines, things like that. So it was really kind of interesting prep work. And then after that, during my PhD, I spent a summer here working as an intern, and I really liked it. After that, I pursued that and I joined MSR. It was a dream come true because all of a sudden you have a chance to work with all these brilliant people that you've read their papers, you've seen them before at conferences and things like that. But now they're colleagues. They're just down the hall.
So who were some of the people at Microsoft Research that you were excited about working with?
Well, first of all, I love working with Andy Wilson, and Andy and I have a long and very fruitful collaboration going on. Most of the projects, actually, that we do together. But if you just go down the hall, I mean, it's awesome hallway. You get Ken Hinckley, you get Sue DeMay, you get Eric Horowitz right at the end of the hallway. I was really excited that Dan Bohusch also was joining. He joined at the same time that I did, and it was really fun. We actually shared an office. We had a joint office in the beginning, so we had our own little think tank.
So tell me about some of the most recent projects that you have. You're going to be presenting some things at WIST.
Yeah, we'll be presenting several different projects. The stuff that's most dear to my current interest, my passions right now, are all these continuation of projects with projector camera systems. We've really been on this kick of trying to use projector camera units to create novel augmented reality experiences. So if you know a little bit of our work, we've done projects like Lightspace, like Beamatron. We've mounted them on your shoulder for kind of personal wearable multi-touch projector style interactions. But lately we're presenting a project. It's really a team project called Room Alive, and that is the idea that now we can not just take one projector, one camera unit, but we can actually just create a network of them. Think about them as smart illumination in this space, and we can plop them around. They can calibrate themselves. They can know about each other, and we can turn the entire space into an augmented reality experience, which is really fascinating because it's creating augmented reality that's shared and it's adaptive to your environment. So if you throw a ball around, it should bounce on your table. One of the goals that we have, it should sound like it's, you know, like it should recognize that this is a carpet versus a floor. We're not quite there yet, but it should bounce differently on carpet and on floor. It should sound differently on carpet and floor, even though it's just a virtual ball that you're really interacting with. And getting to that level of fidelity, getting to that level of interaction is really kind of where we're hoping to take this forward.
So talk about some of the work that you've done where you base the viewer's perspective mm-hmm. on what you project on the surfaces so
sure.
that it would be distorted to someone who's not the user, but they see it correctly. It's almost like you've developed a way to have real holograms.
Right. Physically, they're not holograms.
Yeah.
They are, I think it's more correct to really look at them as view-dependent projections. But you're absolutely right. I think kind of the most straightforward ways to use projector is to treat them as, you know, we're projecting images, and if things remain at the surface level, then for everybody it's going to look correct because at that particular surface. That's why projections at, you know, conferences and things like that look fine. But if you start trying to project something that's three-dimensional, that has shape in it, it becomes really interesting, and you have to start understanding where the user who is seeing this information is looking from what position. And that's the technology that we have right now. So for that to work in a generic sense over any kind of furniture, geometry, and things like that, you need to know a lot about the space so that you can pre-distort the images so that they look correct for that particular view.
So what inspires you? How do you come up with your ideas?
There's many different ways to get to the project ideas. A lot of them crystallize from working at previous projects. You always have something like that you come about, and you kind of have to put it on a back burner, and you're doing that. But in this vein of things, I think one of the things that really inspires me and some of our collaborators is this capability that we can use computer graphics, and we can use computer vision, and we can use these techniques that are developed in computer science to really change the way that we experience technology, that really change the way that we consume entertainment and consume media and all that kind of stuff. I think going forward, it will be really interesting to think that you can literally change your environment in a very lightweight fashion. And what motivates me is that fashion could be very much shared. It's not something that's very personal to me. I mean, there are lots of experiences that are great to keep personal, but this shared understanding of visuals and games and media and all that stuff, it's really important. It's what kind of binds you together with other people in your community, and we can create these magical experiences that are so far only possible in theme parks.
So I want to talk about two aspects of the work that you do. I mean, In one aspect, you're looking forward. You're looking out five, even more years. But you actually had a shipping project with the Mouse 2.0 project. Talk about what it was like to actually work on something that ended up as a shipping product.
The variety of projects is actually what makes Microsoft Research great. So as in your career as a researcher there, you have a chance to really work on everything that's really far out stuff that you know in no foreseeable future people are going to really adapt to, things that like you can think of like how would we redesign something that people use all the time, and sometimes, you know, those kind of redesigns end up making into a product. So Mouse 2.0, or the product was finally known as Microsoft Touch Mouse, is one of those examples where we is again a very collaborative project. We did it with researchers from Microsoft Research Cambridge, from Redmond, from Applied Sciences Group, and Microsoft Hardware at the time. And it kind of coalesced at this point that every one of us had an idea for a new version of a mouse that could do multi-touch. And we all had our own little favorites. But then we realized that all of them have these big commonalities. We said, like, why don't we just put them all together? Let's design a couple different versions. So we designed one that had a camera in there. There were two with the cameras in there. We designed one with a capacitive overlay, with a curved overlay. We designed one that had articulated parts that, you know, like you can move kind of multiple mice around. And we just had them all build. That's an amazing thing with working with, you know, hardware folks. They can just do it right away.
Yeah.
And it was fun to kind of get it all together. And we pitched them all together, see what kind of which people like, which people didn't like, and you know which would be commercially viable. Eventually, we settled onto this idea that that you know multi-touch capacitive overlay would be the technology to do it. Cameras are, as you know you have to calibrate them. You need to. They're a little bit more finicky to make sure that it's a commercial device. But even that, the research kind of didn't stop. So once we got the research project and we published that particular work and showed it, there was a lot of excitement around the company, and we really worked hard to, as soon as possible, transition then into a product. So we got, you know, green lighted on a product plan. But even then, as I said, we had to solve a lot of problems to actually make that going. So I kind of took my hat off as a researcher for a while, and I worked with a product group, which was a whole different world. Like even the language is completely different. I love the contrast there, and it was just a lot of fun to continue solving some of these problems. One of the problems, for example, is that it was the first commercial device. I think it's still the only commercial device that actually had a compound curvature in the touch sensor. But compound curvature is not just curving in a one dimension, not something flexing a sheet, but actually trying to form a form. So you cannot easily print a sheet that actually forms that. You have to have cuts and designs to have that. But that was really important because we wanted to have a device that you can hold comfortably while you're interacting with it. So not something that, you know, you have a couple different modes or grips. So one grip is for using it, and the other grip is for holding it. So solving some of these problems, like how do you design which part of your contacts are just now just there for touching, for gripping the device, and some of them, which ones are there because you want to interact, you want to scroll, you want to click, you want to do something like that. Those are some of the big challenges that we had to face head on, and that's what we did with the team.
You sparked a bit of a frenzy in the industry when you showed one of your projects, a Luma Room, and I think people took to it because they were like, I want that.
Right.
Is it something that I'm going to be able to have here anytime soon?
I sure hope that ideas that we presented there are going to become part of the vocabulary of technologies that people have in their living room. I think, generally speaking, I think we're moving in that direction where more and more the entertainment and the media that we consume is not going to be just tied to the screen. I think a good example, the way that I like to think about this, is Kinect enabled you to not just use a couple buttons to interact with the content, but actually engage your whole body as a controller or as a way of controlling the experience. So in other words, you can extend what you can do with the experience on screen. In Luma Room, we try to do the reverse. We try to say, what if that experience can now start to come to you? Like, you know, your space, your environment, how can that become part of the game, part of the experience? And I think that's what probably captured people's imagination.
Is that one of your challenges, though, is that you're looking at the future and you're showing what ideas might be possible on the horizon, and people are like, shut up and take my money. I want it today.
Well, one of the interesting things I always say at the end of the Luma Room demo is like, because people say, you know, when can I buy it? That's the first question that everybody asks. And the first thing that I ask them is, so how much would you pay for it, right? And the range is great. I mean, you have everything from, you know, maximum $200 to like, oh, just take my money. I don't know, $2,000, $3,000, $5,000, whatever, you know, it's
great. I have a spare kidney.
Yeah. Here's extra organs. What we like to do with most of our projects in that space, actually with all our projects, is we like to kind of open up the horizons. Like, the point of a lot of these demos is like, see what's possible. It's not polished, it's not perfect, it's not, in many ways it's goofy, because we are using current day technology and current day hardware and all this stuff to demonstrate, you know, what could be possible.
Yeah.
But this is what I think we see our role as. I mean, Andy, my collaborator, keeps repeating that as well, in terms of we really want to showcase what is possible, where could we get to, and hopefully it inspires other people around the company and beyond to push to get there.
I think Microsoft almost has a scale of things that they do, from the vision videos where we look at what's possible in the future to shipping products, and you're somewhere in the middle where you're showing what's possible, but in a concrete way.
Well, that's well put. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you. what was one of your favorite projects that you worked on at Microsoft Research?
Wow. Well, I think that's a moving target because it keeps changing. The good thing about my job, and I'm super excited about it. It's one of those jobs where you can, you know, you wake up in the morning and you're like, holy, I can't say. I can't believe, you know, that I have enough freedom and I can, that, you know, they're letting me do this kind of stuff, that I can get away with this kind of stuff. And it's really fascinating because all you, you can get your creative juices going and you can kind of figure out the best track and things like that. And so each project that comes along, it basically gets done because we're super excited about that. That's the honest truth. The project that we're not kind of dying to do usually never get completed. So, but in all honesty, there's lots of projects that stand out in my mind. One of the ones that I have one of the very fond memories is the project we talked about, which is the making of the Microsoft Touch Mouse. And I think that one is really interesting for me because it had all these different periods in that particular project, all these different sections that were really so different from each other. So it's one of those experiences that I would love to, you know, repeat and do some more. Projects like your Luma Room are fabulous because it's collaboration between intern that Brett Jones that worked on that project and also us, and showing it and just seeing people's joy on their faces and packing the room and having a, you know, line out the door for half an hour or an hour wait to go inside and see it. I mean, you feel a little bit like a celebrity, even though nobody knows who you are and whatever. But it's fun. So you have all these different experiences there. But even some projects that are very simple that don't become super famous, don't have million hits on YouTube, can be quite satisfying because all of a sudden you kind of discover something new. I have very fond memories of my first project, the Sphere project here, because it was just one of those things like. The question would typically be, well, what is it good for? And I would be very honest. It's like, I don't really know. But look, we can do this. Like, you know, we weren't able to do this. This is before the, you know, this is just around the time where multi-touch wasn't mainstream. And we were already making not only screens multi-touch, but now we're doing arbitrary kind of curved surfaces with all this rich interactions that later on became kind of mainstream.
How much freedom do you have on what you work on? Or do you get a lot of asks from different groups around Microsoft? Or do you just come up with, you know, huge ideas of things that you might want to work on?
So the way that Microsoft Research is structured is that every researcher really has freedom to pursue their passion and pursue the research that they're most passionate about. So a lot of the research that we engage in is basically following that dream. We're a lot of that lately has been this idea that, you know, we can take projectors and cameras and make augmented reality on the fly. And so as we do these projects, you kind of have the next idea in mind. But as we do them, we keep looking out for opportunities where we can really help and impact the product team. So a lot of times we either try to do that through partnerships, working directly either with you know, units within the company and partnering early on to actually do the projects together. So one of the projects that we're going to show at WIST this year was actually done with a designer and developer from kind of the game studios, Xbox Game Studios part, where we really engaged them early on to help us design some of these interactions and visuals and all that stuff for being able to interact face to face in one of these augmented reality rooms. And oftentimes there are asks, there are specific asks that we get from product teams in terms of, you know, help us figure out this orientation sensor, help us figure out this multi-touch sensor here, or the mouse was a good example, things like that. That happens from time to time where we do it. So it makes us, it keeps us on our toes. I mean, it's never the same. It's never the, I don't have a cookie cutter answer for these things. There's going to be stretches of time where there's no request, and there's a stretches of time where all my time is spent on something that's product related.
One of the things that Bill Buxton talks about is that for any product that gets widespread adoption, it's been worked on for probably at least 20 years. What are the things that are new to researchers today that we might see in the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years?
In my domain of displays and kind of novel visualizations, novel interactions, I think one of the technologies that is starting to become possible on the horizon and people are really looking into it, and I'm fascinated with it personally, is this idea of view, or you can call them lenticular, or different kind of displays. Basically, I think we're already getting to the point where the resolution of the panels of the displays is more than your eye needs to, you know, more than we can consume. So the question becomes what to do with these extra pixels. And one really compelling thing to do with these extra pixels is to actually start directing them so that what you're seeing on a screen and what I'm seeing on these screens is not the same thing. I think those, right now, that's very much still in the research domain, except for the autostereoscopic displays and things like that. But I think the more that we, the more that you look at the horizon of these things, the technology trends are such that I think you'll start having these view-dependent displays coming up, and it's going to change the nature of everything that we consume in there, in that space.
So we often do these vision videos, and the last one that we did 5 years ago was the 2019 vision, mm-hmm. and one of the tenets of that was that we would have very inexpensive displays, and they would be very pervasive. We're halfway to that point, the 2019. how far along are we? Are we on track? Do you see the future as being pervasive displays everywhere?
I think that's already, I mean, I think we overshot that goal by a few years already. I mean, if anything, the number of displays that you personally have, it used to be the personal computer, right, was your kind of your terminal to the world, but right now you have the ability to get that same information on your television, on your phone, on your watch, on your laptop, on your tablet. You know, you have multiple tablets maybe, and multiple things, and your kids have them. We are already living with many displays per person. So I think, yeah, we've overshot them. What's really still not clear to me is how do you connect them together so that they're more than just individual portals into that space. There's not clear benefits yet from having two screens next to each other or a phone and something like that. We're starting to see some of these very direct pairings, watch, phone, things like that. But we're not really seeing kind of an ad hoc benefit yet of really being able to put a couple things together to get a better experience or a completely new experience. I think that's really an opportunity for a lot of people working in kind of these interactions, is that how do you actually tie it all together? I mean, yes, screens are cheap and computational power behind them is relatively inexpensive as well. They're all connected. But some of these interactions, some of these understanding require a very high bandwidth of communication between them, and we're still not quite there. Everything kind of goes directly out to the cloud and is treated as kind of a separate unit. Like really, really not much benefit comes from the idea that, you know, I have a phone and you have a phone and they're near to each other.
All right, thank you so much for being here today, Benko.
No, thank you.